Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, NPR's Jason Bobian on what it's like to come back from Liberia to an Ebola skittish U.S. and his reporter's notebook on what he saw in West Africa.
But first, let's get to the breaking news of the day. Parts of Ottawa, Canada are on lockdown after a series of shootings in and around the Parliament building. 2 days after a suspected jihadist was killed by police after he ran down and killed one of two Canadian soldiers in Quebec. James Fitzmaurice is senior reporter for the CBC in Ottawa. He is in lockdown in his office across from the Parliament building. And James, what can you tell us about the latest of what's going on there?
Well, this is still an ongoing search. Police confirming to us that there is more than one shooter for sure, but they don't know how many, which is why such extraordinary measures are still in place. Some were over 3 hours now since this event occurred or started to occur. There are SWAT teams spread out across the downtown core. They're looking at reports of shooters on roofs of buildings that they're chasing down, trying to see if confirm whether that's true or not. And also, we've just had confirmed now by the government that indeed the soldier who was shot, this all started this morning with a soldier, a Canadian Forces soldier, who was attending a ceremony at the war memorial. He was shot by a gunman. He has died from his wounds. That gunman then fled the scene towards Parliament Hill, hijacked a car on Parliament Hill to bring him to evade police and to bring him right to the front door and ran inside. We have also confirmed we presume it happened in that incident, but a guard was wounded in this exchange at some point. We also know that there was a gunfight in what's called the Hall of Honor in Parliament Hill. It's the equivalent, really, of the rotunda in the Capitol building in Washington, the exact same thing with on one side of the hallway is the House of Commons, the other side is the Senate. On both sides are large rooms where the caucus from both government and opposition meet. There was a volley of gunfire in there. One person was killed, we believe to be the shooter. And we've seen some details, some images coming out from MPs, members of parliament who were in those caucus rooms at the time, barricading themselves in, literally piling the furniture in front of the doors as the shooting erupted to take shelter and make sure no one could get in.
And then there was a report of a shooting at a mall nearby.
That's right. We still are trying to get that exactly confirmed or not. There are conflicting reports of that. We know for sure there are two sites of the shooting, the War Memorial and Parliament Hill. There have been some people insisting there was a shots fired at the shopping mall that's near all of this as well. And that mall is also under lockdown. Shop owners have been ordered to shutter and remain inside. Police are scouring the hallways, checking the place out. But we haven't exactly confirmed whether or not indeed there were shots fired there.
And as we said, this comes just 2 days after a suspected jihadist was killed by police after he ran down two Canadian soldiers in Quebec. One of them was killed in that incident. Do we know more about the gunmen today, who they are?
We don't know anything right now. The people got a good look at certainly the one guy who killed the soldier that we now know died, that he just described as quite tall and wearing jeans and a white shirt and had some sort of scarf wrapped around his head, masking his face. So we don't know more than that at the time. Certainly the government seems to be assuming that this is indeed an attack. I should also mention the U.S. Embassy here in Washington is also under lockdown. It's not far from where this is. They're assuming the worst. And also Canadian Forces bases, Army military bases across the country have been put on at least heightened alert. Some of them have actually been shut down and are also under lockdown because, as they say, they don't know how many people are involved in this attack right now.
And have we heard anything yet from authorities or from Prime Minister Harper?
Simply that some more details that he will be making a statement later today. He was actually in the Parliament buildings when this shooting occurred, was immediately evacuated, taken to a safe location. We are assuming he's at his residence because they've shut down all traffic to and from that neighborhood. So that's all we know so far. We are expecting him, however, to have a statement later today.
All right, we'll continue to follow this story breaking out of Ottawa, Canada, where many parts of the city are still on lockdown after a series of shootings, as we just heard there, in and around the Parliament building. And one soldier, the government has confirmed, who was shot at the War Memorial, has died. James Fitzmaurice of the CBC, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, here in the U.S., the CDC announced today that starting on Monday, all travelers who come into the U.S. from Ebola-affected countries will be monitored for 21 days, given kits to help track their temperature, and asked to report to health officials daily. NPR's Jason Beaubien returned to Washington from Liberia before that mandate. This was his third trip to the region. And so, Jason, nice to speak with you on this soil.
Yes, good to speak with you as well, Robin.
And you told us when you were last in Liberia that you saw a marked difference there. You saw more aid workers. And also when you were there, those treatment centers opened. So what is happening at the treatment centers? Are they effective? They were meant to bring people out of the hospitals to free up beds for people without Ebola, bring people out of their homes so they wouldn't infect families, into these specific treatment centers. What did you see?
Yeah, absolutely. And they are accomplishing that. As soon as new ones open, they fill up with Ebola patients. So clearly there's a huge need for them. What is really interesting, particularly in the capital of Liberia, in Monrovia, it seems that you have gotten enough beds right now that you actually end up having some empty beds at most of the facilities. But unlike before, where they were turning people away, now they actually say, yes, we can be taking people, and they are taking people. I went to the Doctors Without Borders ELWA 3 hospital in Monrovia, and they actually have a drive-up triage section where people come in. There are the guys there in like the spacesuits ushering the cars in, and they come into this like fenced-in area, and then about 12 feet away under this tent, a doctor stands there, and they yell back and forth to the people that are in the taxis or in the cars, asking them about their symptoms and trying to do this sort of triage dance as these vehicles are coming in. And if they determine that it is an Ebola patient, they take them out, often carry them out. And there is a constant flow of people coming through there, which just shows you how this outbreak is still not under control.
Well, you tell one story of what happens sometimes when the doctors don't think that they are Ebola candidates and tell them to go to the hospital.
Yeah, there was this one guy that came up, and he had a relative in the back seat, and he was trying to get the Ebola hospital to admit this guy. And the doctor's saying, clearly this is not Ebola. And he's saying, well, just let him in anyway, because if you don't tell me and you don't test him for Ebola, then none of the other hospitals will treat him. And we've tried getting him help elsewhere, but they won't take him because they think he's an Ebola patient. You're telling me he's not. And the people at the hospital said, we can't bring him in here because he's likely to pick it up from the other patients around him. Mm. So this guy just was sort of unable to get any healthcare anywhere.
What a catch-22.
Yeah.
You mentioned people pulling up in taxis, too. We hear that taxi cab drivers are being enlisted to help out. You know, they're on the front lines.
A lot of people in this part of the world don't own their own cars. So people often use taxis to get around. And by taxis, we're talking about sort of beat up old Datsuns oftentimes. You know, it used to be that you get like six people packed into them, and they've actually passed new laws saying that you can't pack people in the way they used to. But the taxi drivers are being enlisted to try to help, both to identify people who they think might be, and to protect the taxi drivers themselves, mm-hmm. teaching them how to clean out their vehicles, how to spray down the back seats, and try to stop these vehicles from being a vessel for transmission.
Well, Jason, we've been talking about Liberia, and we want to get some more thoughts on that. But meanwhile, what is your sense of where this virus is in Guinea?
You know, Guinea is where this outbreak began. It did seem like Guinea was getting it under control way back, you know, earlier on this year. It seemed like this was going to get taken care of and wrapped up like other Ebola outbreaks in the past. Then it came surging back. So you still are having a significant outbreak in Guinea, although it is at a lower level than in both Sierra Leone or Liberia. Part of the problem is that the U.S. has sort of taken on Liberia as its country, and Britain has taken on Sierra Leone as the country it's focusing most of its efforts on. There's been sort of an assumption that France was going to play that role in Guinea. It has to some degree, but it has not been at the level that either Britain has done in Sierra Leone or the U.S. has done in Liberia. It still continues to have this virus spreading quite widely.
Well, and meanwhile, this was your third trip to West Africa. This is your first time home to the U.S. since the cases arose here. How's that different returning?
It's night and day coming back this time. I mean, before I just flew through the airport, came in, you know, got out of the airport, no big deal. This time I came in at Dulles. I have the global entry thing where you can do that little computer thing. Usually they just wave you right through. A big X came up. They sent me over to talk to the Customs and Border Patrol people. They asked me some questions about what I'd been doing in Liberia. I got sent over to another secondary screening place where they again were asking me more questions. They did not take my temperature when I got in at Dulles. Now everyone is going to have their temperature taken who's going into this secondary screening. But they also gave me a note to give to a doctor. If I end up in a clinic, it's got the number for the CDC that the doctor should call. The other thing, however, is just the atmosphere here is very different. I mean, clearly people are much more concerned about this. And you feel it. There are some people who clearly are uncomfortable having me in their presence. And I understand that people are afraid, but we do have to put this in perspective. We can't just say that because people have been in West Africa or people are West African that they have Ebola. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're there, you can see how this disease gets spread. It is containable. You can stay safe while you're there. And I think we do need to keep that in mind as we think about this entire outbreak and think about the aid workers and journalists and other people who are going back and forth trying to get it under control.
But meanwhile, Jason, you have family, friends. Are you imposing some sort of a semi-different behavior yourself? Are you going to be taking your temperature? Are you going to refrain from hugging? What's your thought?
You know, it is interesting. I mean, some news organizations are keeping their people out for 21 days. That sends the message that anyone who's been in West Africa is somehow going to be carrying this virus back. I don't think that that is necessary. However, I refrain from hugging people. I avoid shaking hands with people just because I know that some people are uncomfortable with it. But if it turns out that I ended up somehow getting Ebola over there, they have to throw out the book in terms of how this disease is transmitted. It's transmitted by people who are caring for people who are very sick, who are touching people who are very sick. And that's not at all what I was doing over there. That never happened while I was there. Yeah. And I know that. But I do try to just make people a little bit more comfortable around me. For the next few weeks, I'm just keeping to myself, my own little body bubble here.
That's Jason Bobian, NPR's global health correspondent, recently back from Liberia. Jason, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And by now, you've probably heard that Ben Bradley, the former editor of The Washington Post, who stood by reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein as they pursued the Watergate scandal, has died. Part of his legacy, that Watergate investigation, led to 40 people going to prison and President Richard Nixon resigning.
Here is Ben Bradley in 2006 speaking to his friend Jim Lehrer on the PBS NewsHour about his work.
It changes your life, the pursuit of truth. And it, at least if you know that you have tried to find the truth and gone past the first apparent truth towards the real truth, it's very exciting, I find.
We want to talk to David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, about Ben Bradley's passing. And David, you know, we've been hearing in your reporting about his role in Watergate, the Pentagon Papers. We want you to elaborate on that in a bit. But the New York Times also printed those secret war documents. So for the people thinking, didn't he do what editors do? Can you try to start by explaining why Ben Bradley was such a lion? You know, how does he compare to other editors in history?
I think he's really a defining editor of the, second half of the 20th century in a role that supersedes mere newspapering to journalism itself. He combined two twin impulses that I think were both admirable and attractive to journalists and to readers. And those impulses, I'd say, was that he really believed in standing for something. He sought that out throughout his career at the Post in particular. And he also embraced a great sense of fun, of brio. And I think one of the things he goaded his reporters and his journalists to do was to really reflect the fun of the world around him. He looked at the dry, drab slabs of prose that often emanated from newspapers, including his own in his early years. And he says, you know, we can do better than this. And he really reinvented the pages of the Post, as well as reinventing the metabolism of it and of setting the sights higher for the Post in a way that transformed journalism.
We had a magnetism. Jeremy, I was thinking, I heard a historian, John Meacham, say this morning, I am very heterosexual, but I was one of the men who just, there was almost a sexual attraction to Ben Bradley. He had this kind kind of magnetism for people, which, you know, at times he led them, you know, into war. We want to hear the war that the paper waged over the Pentagon Papers. Maybe sometimes they followed him and they shouldn't have. But take up the Pentagon Papers, David. Just remind people, things like Watergate and Pentagon seem facile when they're in a movie. They were scary at the time.
Right. None of this was foreordained, right? And we think of Watergate and we think of the great, you know, Oscar-winning movie All the President's Men, which really is, was electric to me as a young reporter and has a lot of that power today. But the Pentagon Papers several years earlier were a moment where the relationship with the government and the press was really about to be defined. And it was over whether or not the New York Times could publish the secret history of the Vietnam War. If you think of the era in the early 1970s, it was a time of tumult and protest and anger over America's role in Vietnam, a situation that Nixon had inherited, of course, from under President Johnson. But nonetheless, the New York Times had obtained this. Daniel Ellsberg was going to press with it. The Nixon administration was enjoining him from publishing that. And the Times took it all the way up to the Supreme Court. What Ben Bradlee did with the support of Katharine Graham, the head of the Washington Post, and the company, its parent company, was to say not we stand askance from our competitor, the Times, but we will stand shoulder to shoulder with you. And this did two things. It broadened the aperture so that it wasn't just a fight between Nixon and those crazies at the New York Times, but it was a fight between the White House and the press writ large. And it took on that kind of titanic focus when it was adjudicated by the Supreme Court. And also it said to the world, to journalism, and particularly to the newsroom of the Washington Post, we are an equal of the New York Times. You know, Bradlee had essentially taken over what had been a pretty mediocre paper in the nation's capital in the 1960s, and he was trying to force it to a place at the grown-ups table and a really select group. What occurred was that he ensured that the Post not only stood up for journalistic principle, but also that the Post had earned its place at the table of a very select group of news organizations.
Well, and you mentioned the New York Times, and we spoke earlier this week. I moderated a panel here in Boston with the former executive editor of the New York Times, Jill Abramson, and David Carr of the New York Times. And Jill Abramson talked about Ben Bradlee. This was the night before he died. Let's listen.
He, in my book, is the most consequential editor of my lifetime because I think he made the Washington Post into an incredibly interesting and electric national publication of consequence. And I think, you know, he was the bravest kind of editor during Watergate.
And David, she went on to talk about how the Post's editors and reporters stayed loyal to Bradlee even during a scandal on his watch when the Washington Post had to return its 1981 Pulitzer won by reporter Janet Cook for a story that turned out to have been made up.
Right. And it was a story. I think it's a telling incident for journalists and for the public generally. It was a story called Jimmy's World about an 8-year-old heroin user and addict. But Jimmy didn't exist and his family didn't exist. And there were these little warning signs where, you know, editors along the way had said, you know, can you introduce us to Jimmy's family or can we learn more? And the reporter Janet Cook wasn't able to fill in some of those blanks. People at the Post wanted to believe this story. They wanted to believe the story because it was electric. They wanted to believe the story because it was heartbreaking and seemed to signal what was undeniably true, that the scourge of drugs was destroying families in this incredibly compelling story and package. And they wanted to believe it because Janet Cook herself was a young African-American woman, very stylish writer, very promising talent. And, you know, Ben Bradlee had wanted to make sure that African-Americans would rise in his paper after all the dominant paper in what was becoming a strongly African-American city. And, you know, the desire to believe can even lead great journalists astray. And I think that Watergate had in some ways emboldened Bradlee and, among others, Bob Woodward, then atop the Metro desk at The Washington Post and seemingly on his way to fill Ben Bradlee's shoes, that their instinct was golden and that they couldn't be led astray. And in fact, their desire to believe led one of their young protégés to be able to hoodwink them all.
We're speaking with David Folkenflik, and this is Here and Now. And David, one more thing. There are critics of the kind of investigative journalism that Ben Bradlee championed, book titles like From Watergate to Monica Gate, and some journalists who feel that after Watergate, the press went overboard in thinking it had to be adversarial at all times.
Well, look, we've got to recognize what an incredible act of courage it was to embark on Watergate and their continued investigations at a time that much of the rest of the press dismissed it as a caper or thought of it as a post-obsession. That said, there was this notion, an almost paranoiac idea, that somehow reporters would find wrong under every rock and couldn't see right sometimes or decency sometimes when it was right in front of them. I think it's hard to blame Ben Bradley, Bob Woodward, and Carl Bernstein for taking the approach they did to Watergate at that time, or at least as relentlessly as they did, when so much was at stake for the nation and for the newspaper.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik with just some thoughts on the life and legacy, big legacy, of former Washington Post editor Ben Bradley. David, thanks so much.
You bet.
And here is a portion of President Obama awarding Ben Bradley the Presidential Medal of Freedom last year.
When Ben retired, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan put the admiration of many into a poem. O rare Ben Bradley, his reign has ceased, but his nation stands, its strength increased.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Starting today, Target is offering free shipping on all online orders through December 20th. The retailer is hoping that this holiday season goes better than last year, when Target suffered a massive data breach just weeks before Christmas. And since then, there has been a lot of bad press for Target, a change in leadership, and lagging sales. CNN's Maggie Lake joins us from New York with more on this. Maggie, welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy. Nice to be here. Can you believe we're talking about Christmas? It's not even Halloween.
I know. It's not even Halloween. But why does Target say it's doing this now?
Well, listen, they need to get customers back in the store. That data breach, and frankly, the tough economy competition has meant that they just don't have the market share they used to. And you can feel that. I mean, I've been in Target stores, and there doesn't seem to be the crowds in there they're used to. So they're jumping on the free shipping bandwagon. And it matters. Free shipping matters. There's no doubt about it. There's stats kicking around. I'm sure you've probably seen that 60% of online shoppers dump out of their cart if they start to see those extra charges add up. The problem for Target, I think, is that everyone else is already doing it. This doesn't really make them stand out for the crowd if they're just catching up. And by the way, it's not just shipping. It's free shipping on those returns, too, that customers are looking for. So I'm not sure this is going to move the needle for them.
But you're saying that a consumer would actually make a decision to buy or not buy something based on free shipping alone?
It appears so, based on what the researchers are telling us. But I know anecdotally, too, it sounds a little bit crazy, maybe, especially if you got a couple of $100 worth of items in there and you feel like you're getting a good deal. But when you see that tax and shipping, it sometimes bumps you up into that other level when you know you can get free shipping elsewhere. And that's the thing. It's so competitive. You can X out, go to the next site, get the same thing for free shipping. Why would you pay?
Well, and let's talk about why they have to do this. And you brought up that breach. 40 million credit and debit cards were compromised last year during that breach. It cost Target an estimated $110 million. How are they still being hurt by that breach, though? Wouldn't consumers have forgiven them? They're not the only ones to have had something like this happen.
That's absolutely right. I think the problem is that I think people, by the way, are nervous a lot when they're going in to use their credit cards. I think transparency is an issue. A lot of companies face crisis. If you can get out in front quickly, reach out to your consumers, communicate. We've seen time and time again that makes a difference. Target didn't get good marks doing that, but I don't think it's just a security breach, Jeremy. I think it's more than that. Again, I'm going to use my own personal channel checking when I go into Target. And it used to be that you ran in there to pick up some laundry detergent or something, and then you ended up walking out with a cart full of items because there were a lot of cool things you saw that were hip and cheap. That's not been the case as much anymore. It seems diluted, and it kind of seems like everyone else, they've got the same kind of lineup of products. And so you're just not seeing those sales translate. So I think they have a host of problems. So the security breach and that hangover, not helping at all.
And the free shipping, by the way, is not the only solution. They've got a new CEO, Brian Cornell. What else is he doing to try to revive Target?
Well, it looks like he's going to concentrate on just that point I brought up about differentiating Target again, kind of reviving that brand. And remember, they really stood out from the pack and stole so much business, especially away from Walmart, by having that hip associated with them, right? They paired with designers. They really invented that space of getting designers to partner for these short-term events. The products would go, but if you got in there, they were much cheaper than they would be, say, on the runway. And that had a real vibe around it. People really gravitated updated. They checked out what was going on. They haven't been concentrating on that as much. They still have some promotionals, but it looks like they're trying to return to that. They're partnering with Tom's, the footwear company, for example, over the holidays. Looks like they're trying to get some more exclusive items back in. And he's also been talking about maybe moving away from some of the other directions they went in, especially with food. Hmm. They sort of devote a lot of space to food, and it looks like that wasn't really working out for them.
And Maggie, one word answer here. We heard the other day that the holiday shopping season is going to be good. Then I see today maybe it's not going to be so good. Do you think good, bad, or just okay?
I think good on the upscale. I think a struggle when you're in the middle.
Maggie Lake of CNN, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now.
As Halloween approaches, police in Denver, Colorado have put out a warning about marijuana-infused candy. Recreational marijuana is legal, but pot in food is hard to see. Dispensary owner Patrick Johnson says marijuana candy makers often simply take regular candy and spray pot oil onto it.
The problem is that some of these products look so similar to candy that's been on the market that we've eaten as children, that there's really no way for a child or a parent or anybody, even an expert in the field, to tell you whether or not a product is infused or not.
And last year, 9 children in Colorado ended up in the hospital after eating pot-infused products. There have been 2 deaths linked to the products, including a college student who ate a marijuana cookie and jumped off his hotel balcony. At a meeting this week, the Colorado Health Department proposed a ban on edibles, but after howls of protest, they backed away. So a state task force has been grappling with the question of how to regulate marijuana-infused edibles like candy, brownies, and cookies. State Representative Jonathan Singer is on the task force. He joins us from Longmont, Colorado. And Jonathan, you were a supporter of recreational marijuana in general. Were you caught by surprise by this edibles problem?
You know, one of the things that we certainly didn't expect was the fact that the edibles market for marijuana is somewhere between 20% and 40% of the total market in marijuana. And so the time that we spent regulating marijuana really up until this year was focused on the plants and what people could smoke. And we weren't thinking about as much as it related to edibles specifically.
Right.
So this was a big change.
Yeah. Well, were you for a ban on the edibles?
Actually, just to set the record straight, there were only 2 sitting lawmakers that publicly endorsed the Yes on Amendment 64 campaign to legalize marijuana in Colorado. It was myself from Boulder County, Democrat, and a Tea Party Republican. Out of 100 lawmakers, there were only 2. And so when Amendment 64 was envisioned, it included the legalization of edible marijuana. And so a ban on edible marijuana would violate our own state constitution.
So you're saying you're against a ban on edibles on legal grounds, but what do you think has to happen? Are you more worried about kids trying to buy the candies or trying to get their hands on it, or people mistakenly giving it to them, for instance, on Halloween, or it being left out and kids getting it accidentally? I mean, what are your concerns and what do you think should be done?
Well, first of all, I think people should know in Colorado, we have a very robust regulatory system that really encourages parental responsibility. And really what this task force is dealing with is what the candy or the baked goods look like outside of the package. Right now, every edible marijuana item needs to leave a marijuana dispensary in a child-proof, opaque container, basically a resealable locking Ziploc bag, not just a bag that anyone could open easily.
We picture tearing open a plastic bag of candy. This, you can't just do that. You have to have a resealable bag.
Exactly. And even some of the gummy bears that you see are actually now sold in the same kind of pill bottle you would have an Advil pill in. And so the question is, once it's outside the package, I don't care whether you're 6 years old or 60 years old, I want to be able to know whether or not I'm looking at a marijuana cookie or an Oreo cookie. And so I'd like to see those individual products stamped, shaped, or marked in some way that makes it easily identifiable for the average consumer, whether you're 6 years old or 60 years old, to make sure that people know what they're putting in their bodies.
So this is one of the proposals from the task force. But I just want to stay with that, your thinking, for a second, because What about when it's still in the container and getting across the dosage information? Thinking of adults as well at this point, we of course remember New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd went to Colorado to report on the new marijuana industry and ate a whole pot-infused candy bar and hallucinated in her hotel room for 8 hours because she didn't understand to take a small bite and wait for a reaction. So what about the labeling even while it's in the package?
Well, and just to backtrack real quickly, the only people allowed in dispensaries are people over the age of 21. And we recently had a sting operation done across the state of Colorado to see if pot sellers were selling to anyone underage. And the dispensaries passed with 100% compliance. So we've actually, moved in a way that's showing that the industry is stepping up and doing the right thing.
But I guess my question is, do you still need to get out more word somehow through campaigns or something about how to take the stuff, even if you're an adult?
Absolutely. What we're doing now at the state is requiring that by October 30th, every marijuana piece sold be sold in single serving sizes of 10 milligrams. And so someone like a Maureen Dowd or any tourist isn't going to be ingesting 30 or 50 or 100 milligrams in one serving. The other thing is the industry is actually stepping up with their own public education campaign saying start low, go slow. It might take an hour or even 2 or 2.5 hours for someone to actually feel the intoxicating effects of marijuana.
So you mentioned that going forward, one of the things you do want is that marijuana-infused edibles be clearly marked once they're outside the packaging by either a stamp or something. Gina Carbone of the advocacy group Smart Colorado, who also sits with you on the task force, says the same thing. It's got to be identified some way, a different coloring, some kind of a stamp or something. Can you do this in time for Halloween?
Well, no. We cannot. And I want to put this in perspective for a second. I think that parents need to be taking care of their kids, regardless of whether it's marijuana that their kids might be getting their hands on. Cosmetics and personal care products are actually the number one most accidentally ingested substance by children.
But of course, the difference is nobody's going to be giving out lipsticks on Halloween. So in addition to the campaigns that we're hearing about, the messaging, what else do you think Colorado needs to do?
When I was going trick-or-treating, my parents said, don't take any candy that's outside of its packaging. And this is the same. My recommendation is, make sure you know what that candy is. Make sure it's individually wrapped in a wrapper and in by a product that you recognize. And if it's been adulterated in any way, toss it away.
That's Jonathan Singer, state representative from Colorado. He sits on the Colorado Marijuana Enforcement Division's Edibles Working Group, trying to tackle the issues surrounding edible marijuana products. Representative Singer, Jonathan, thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Secretary of State John Kerry is on the road again. He was in Berlin today, where he said the Obama administration will not cut Congress out of the loop regarding a possible deal with Iran over its nuclear program.
I personally believe, as does the president, that Congress has an extremely important role to play in this, and Congress will play a role in this.
Iran is just one of the issues on John Kerry's plate these days. There's the fight against ISIS, Ebola, the tensions with Russia. So how is he handling those issues? And more broadly, how do you judge a Secretary of State's performance? We want to explore those questions with Professor Jeremy Suri. He teaches at the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs and in the History Department at the University of Texas. He's also the author of Henry Kissinger and the American Century, among other books. He's with us from KUT in Austin. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with John Kerry, the current Secretary of State. Is it possible to judge his performance at this point?
Well, I think we can begin to judge his performance, and I think we can say two things. We can say he's been incredibly energetic, but so far, at least, there aren't great results to see.
Why not? Why are there not great results to see, in your view?
Well, I think, first of all, he's inherited a very difficult international environment, but I think what he has lacked is a strategic focus which allows him to take advantage of some of the opportunities that are out there to produce something that can change the international system. He's been in a very reactive mode, and the best secretaries of state do not just react, they lead.
Well, let's talk about some successful secretaries of state, and we should remember that this goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson as the
yes.
first secretary of state back in 1790. Tell us about your favorites over the years.
Well, I have some good oldies and I have some less oldies who I like. Certainly, John Quincy Adams is, I think, probably the conventional wisdom among historians is that he's the best Secretary of State. He is the one who authored the Monroe Doctrine, and he's the one who really shepherded the United States through a very difficult international period when Britain and France and other countries were looking to gobble us up. John Hay, who was Secretary of State in the late 19th century, played a crucial role as America rose to become a global power. He really articulated and led the formation of the Foreign Service and many of the elements of American foreign policy that we take for granted today. So John Hay is also interesting, by the way, because he was Abraham Lincoln's secretary. Henry Stimson, who played a crucial role during the Depression as Herbert Hoover's Secretary of State before becoming Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of War, played a crucial role in that interim period as the United States dealt with both a desire to avoid war at home, but also the difficulties of managing the rise of fascism overseas. And then, of course, Dean Acheson, Henry Kissinger, and James Baker, I think, were the great secretaries of state of the Cold War. They were responsible more than anyone else for the United States coming out on top in the Cold War.
And did these guys have much in common? Was there something that they were all doing?
You know, I think they had a number of things in common that are worth exploring. First, all of them had a philosophy of how the world worked. All of them, to one extent or another, were realists. They believed that power mattered, but that power had to be negotiated. All of them were multilateral. None of them believed the United States could act alone. All of them believed that resources mattered, but that you had to spend money abroad to get value at home. And most significant, I think, all of them recognized that war should only be a last resort. These were secretaries of state who sought to avoid war, not to throw around American military force.
Including James Baker and Henry Kissinger, you would say that
yes,
they did those things?
Yes, absolutely. One of Kissinger's great innovations was to open relations with our former adversaries in China and to some extent the Soviet Union and create a more stable negotiated peace during the Cold War rather than the continual conflicts that had really brought us into Vietnam, were responsible for the Cuban situation. And James Baker, he did, of course, oversee American power during the first Persian Gulf War, but his goal was to bring that war to a quick close and then negotiate a settlement to the Arab-Israeli conflict, and he came pretty close, I think.
We're speaking with Professor Jeremy Suri from the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs and the Department of History at the University of Texas about secretaries of state, and you're listening to Here and Now. And let's go back to a Secretary of State that we all remember, Secretary of State Colin Powell, who under President George W. Bush back in 2003 went before the United Nations in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and said that the U.S. had to invade because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
Iraq's behavior demonstrates that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
And of course, we now know there were no weapons of mass destruction, but is history going to judge him as that's his legacy as Secretary of State of going before and saying something that turned out not to be true?
Well, it will be hard to talk about Secretary Powell without talking about that speech at the UN. He brought so much credibility as a war hero and as a long-serving member of the defense establishment to the State Department and did a lot of good things, especially in reorganizing the department itself, in bringing more money into the department, hiring better people. But I do think he put his name on information that was not true and contributed to what many will see in retrospect as a war that did not serve American interests. And so it will be hard to separate him from that legacy.
What about Hillary Clinton's legacy and something that a lot of people are going to be looking into, especially if she does run for president?
I think she has a very mixed legacy. I think there are a lot of positives. She played an instrumental role, I think, in opening countries like Burma to democratization. It took her a little while, but her administration embraced the Arab Spring and encouraged what we hope will be a long-term effort at democratization in the Middle East. And she was very well respected among our partners and sometimes adversaries in Asia and elsewhere. So she did a very competent job at that level. But of course, the tragedy in Benghazi and the killing of an American ambassador there and the continued unrest in that area will plague her. It's not clear she could have prevented that, but it does appear that she did not react to those circumstances in the most forthright way. And this will pose problems for her legacy.
Well, and on other things that it's not clear that she could have prevented, you could look at the Arab Spring and say it's turned into a mess in a lot of the countries where there was an uprising. And also when we talk about the pivot to Asia and the Obama administration's planned pivot to Asia, that hasn't worked out the way that they hoped either.
Well, this is true, but none of these have been disastrous. And I think you could argue that if you take a country like North Korea, we have not been able to reverse their nuclear development. But they've been kept pretty much in the box by American foreign policy. She played a key role with that. The Chinese are not necessarily seeing eye to eye with us on all issues. But the relationship has been managed reasonably well. It certainly was, it seems to me, in the first administration. And the Arab Spring did not produce the results we'd like to see. But I still think many parts of the Middle East are a little better off. I'd rather have an Egypt with an engaged public, even now that they have a military dictatorship, but still having gone through this process. And one could argue what we're seeing in Hong Kong, what we've seen in Ukraine and elsewhere are after spills of a larger democratic wave that's producing disorder around the world, but also producing the possibility for change. And maybe we'll see that in Iran sometime soon.
Professor Suri, just to wrap this up, if you were questioning a nominee for Secretary of State in the Senate before they were confirmed, what would you ask them? What would be the one thing you would want to know from somebody to determine whether they were going to be a successful Secretary of State?
I think the most important question is the question, how do you see the world and how can you improve America's position in the world? That's your job as Secretary of State. If you don't have an idea how to do that, if you're just going to manage crises, you're not going to be successful.
Professor Jeremy Suri teaches at the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs and in the Department of History at the University of Texas. He's also the author of Henry Kissinger and the American Century, among other books. Professor Suri, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And a question to you. Are you ready to judge Hillary Clinton's term as Secretary of State? We just talked about it there. But do you think she did a good job? Do you think it's too soon to tell? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.